You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Kevin Alexander, an advanced heart failure trained cardiologist and assistant professor of cardiovascular medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kevin Alexander, amyloid specialist and heart failure cardiologist at Stanford University. Welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on ATTR-CM. Today, we'll discuss barriers in the diagnosis and treatment of ATTR-CM with our guest, Dr. Jesus Pino-Marino. Dr. Pino-Marino is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Hawaii and an advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist at the Queens Medical Center in Honolulu. He also leads the amyloidosis program at Queens Medical Center. Welcome to In Discussion and welcome, Jesus.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alessandro. Thank you so much, Kevin, for this wonderful invitation.
Great. Well, Jesus, I've asked all of our guests the icebreaker question, what someone would do if they weren't doing their current job. So if you weren't an amyloid specialist and heart failure cardiologist, what would you be doing in life?
So I think that if I wasn't a cardiologist and heart failure specialist, but I was still a doctor, probably would be doing critical care. That was something that was very passionate early in my career when I was a medical student and resident. But if I wasn't a doctor at all, I will say that something that I really enjoy to discuss are macroeconomic and how all the political aspects of the country will affect your economy. So those are like the two things that I am passionate outside of advanced heart failure.
Nice, nice. Well, you know, I think the topic of barriers to healthcare is pretty broad. And there's kind of barriers to healthcare in general, and then maybe some things that are specific to ATTR itself. I thought we could maybe start broadly and then hone in on ATTR. You're someone that's practiced in the wide variety of healthcare settings in the U.S. and in other countries. Could you give us a little perspective about what are some issues with access to care that you've seen during your training and medical practice?
Yes, I think that I have the opportunity to be exposed to multiple healthcare systems, including countries in Latin America, as well as the U.S. and nowadays in Hawaii. And most of them have something in common, and one is access to specialist. And this access to a specialist can divide it in different ways. One of them is not having insurance. The other aspect is distance to where these doctors and specialists are located. Another aspect that we see frequently are disparities on the care of the patients and social determinants of health, including food access, transportation access. So those are like the most common aspects that we tend to see that will affect your access to healthcare.
We had the privilege of collaborating together on a project looking at the impact of social determinants of health and ATTR-CM specifically. And that study showed that there are various components of that of social determinants of health, such as financial security and transportation, that are big drivers to delays and diagnosis for ATTR-CM specifically. Maybe tell us about what you've observed in Hawaii and practicing in that setting.
So Hawaii has a special characteristic that no other centers in the U.S. have, you know, is geographically isolated from the U.S. We are about 2,500 miles away from the mainland U.S. or California. So that is about 6 hours commercial flight. So it is not easy for patients to get access to care outside of Hawaii. But within Hawaii, there are multiple islands. So patients have to move between islands to receive the care that they need. So something that we have identified in Hawaii is access to us in the amyloid center is limited by those multiple islands where patients have to travel frequently to see the specialists. And they cannot drive, they cannot go to boat. So the only way to communicate between islands is airplanes. So that is the strongest determinant of health that we identified so far.
when it comes to ATTR diagnosis, what do you feel like are some of the areas where the breakdown occurs? Is it the patients getting to healthcare providers? Is it patients are seeing the healthcare providers, but there's limited awareness of thinking about the disease and doing the diagnostic test? Or is it, you know, there is a suspicion, but then getting to the amyloid center is the issue, or is it a combination of all those things?
Yes, and we can call it the triple threat. And I think that all of them are part of this delay in diagnosis. Number one, it's difficult for patients, particularly in Hawaii, to get access to healthcare providers. We just don't have enough healthcare providers. And we just don't have enough across the multi-islands in Hawaii. The second aspect is not all physicians are aware about cardiac amyloidosis or amyloidosis in general. When we were in med school, this was defined as a very rare disease. And the symptoms and signs of the disease initially are very unspecific. So you have to have a significant suspicions or high suspicions to kind of thinking amyloidosis for these patients. And once those patients get identified, getting access to diagnostic tools like technetium ferrophosphate that is not widely available in all the islands also can delay the diagnosis of the disease. And subsequently that, getting access to specialists that are familiarized with amyloidosis. And we in Hawaii have a very small group of physicians that really take care of amyloidosis. And finally, after the patient has been diagnosed and have lived through all this journey, is to get access to therapeutic interventions that can decrease their morbidity and mortality.
There's a lot to unpack there. I think several steps along the pipeline that lead to diagnostic delays in diagnosis and treatment. And it's kind of an attrition, you know, people are lost at each one of those stages. And even though you specifically outlined what the barriers are in Hawaii, I think this applies in different flavors in other healthcare settings. I think about in California, where it is in the continental U.S., but it's a wide catchment area, and a lot of patients live outside of the major metropolitan cities. They can commute hours to get to these healthcare centers and have access to things like scintigraphy scans. So, you know, I kind of wanted to go through some of those things you said in a little more detail. When it comes to the recognition of ATTR, what are some of the common pitfalls or things that you see physicians miss when encountering patients with ATTR?
I think that it's particularly missing their big red flags. And I will say that one of them is the patients with bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome. You know, this is a big red flag that is frequently get overseen by physicians. The second one is they relate in all clues that we used to have. For example, low voltage EKG. And lately we have identified that not all the patients with TTR cardiomyopathy will have this low voltage EKG. Other clues that are frequently overlooked or underlooked are patients who have spinal stenosis or tendon rupture. If you don't have the suspicions, you can see these clues as a just orthopedic problems. But if you combine them with cardiovascular symptoms, I think that this can give you a higher yield to suspect amyloidosis. Also, rely only on echocardiogram findings, or the patient doesn't have amyloidosis because the echo doesn't show severe LVH or hypertrophy. So I will say that signs and symptoms sometimes get overlooked, and diagnostic tools can get misinterpreted.
Yeah. And on that last point with misinterpretation of diagnostic tools, do you encounter issues with misdiagnosis with, say, light chain amyloidosis and interpreting some of the hematologic assessment? And then what's your experience been with scintigraphy scans and how those have been performed and interpreted?
I think that we, at some phase of in our amyloidosis programs, we identified that patients were diagnosed with amyloidosis just because the UPEP spending immunization was abnormal. Any abnormality was referred as amyloidosis, like, for example, the presence of polyclonal gammopathy or elevated free light change, regardless of the ratio, were initially misinterpreted as amyloidosis. So I will say this is one point that we can work with physicians and primary cares, is teaching them the clear cutoff to diagnose or to rule out AL amyloidosis based on the UPEP SPECT immunization. The second part that we noticed with technetium pyrophosphate or the scintigraphy was many patients were overdiagnosed with amyloidosis, particularly because we used the old criteria, heart to contralateral ratio, or we didn't exclude the blood pool in the initial interpretation of these technologies. So those are like the big encounters related to technetium pyrophosphate and free light change that we have identified. Something that we did was educate the community and educate it to the point that every patient and every technetium pyrophosphate or scintigraphy that we are doing recommend that if AL amyloidosis hasn't been ruled out, it has to be done before the diagnosis of TTR has been made. And this has helped us a lot to decrease this false positive or negative ratio.
Yeah, that highlights an important point. I think one of the challenges with increasing awareness and detection of ATTR is there's not that many of us amyloid specialists and experts. And the majority of patients out there are going to see general cardiologist or primary care physicians and so forth. And we task them with having to remember all the extra cardiac red flags, as well as things that they might see on imaging. And if they see all those things, you consider doing a technetium pyrophosphate scan. Along the way, if those scans are not performed properly or misinterpreted, relying on the ordering physicians to be able to kind of navigate all that. So I like what you said about the reports, having a statement in there that there should be a workup for a monoclonal gammopathy, and that the PYP scan isn't a study done in isolation and needs to be interpreted in the context of everything. And, you know, I totally agree with you in terms of performing those scans, that the SPECT imaging is crucial for determining where that uptake is occurring. Is it in the myocardium or is it blood pool artifact? And I think that that's also where I see a lot of false positives. There's only planar images, and that's blood pool artifact is misinterpreted. And then we repeat it at our center, and you know, many of those end up being negative studies. What's your relationship with community physicians in terms of improving the pipeline to get patients to your clinic?
So we went as far as give them my personal cell phone, because we know how hard it is to get access to specialists, particularly specialists cardiology or advanced heart failure. They know that when they suspect that the patient have amyloidosis or that the patient have the diagnosis because they ordered the testing, they can refer those patients for treatment or further evaluation. And those patients then tend to be prioritized in our center. And if they encounter any difficulty, they can call me particularly to discuss this. So I think that our relationship is growing aggressively, because we have been doing education, aggressive education in the community. They are more aware. Through this education, we are able to have a better relationship with these primary care physicians and cardiologists. Not only those, also with oncologists, neurologists, GI, and lately, even with orthopedic surgeons.
What I take away from that is that you have to really be intentional in engaging with healthcare providers. I think if you have a flyer that sits in an office or do a didactic and wait for the referrals to hit your in-basket, that's only going to catch a small number of patients. It's insufficient. Really meeting patients and physicians where they are and reaching out is what it takes to get patients in. Not dissimilar to advanced heart failure in general, right? When we want to try to bring patients in before they've had irreversible kind of end organ damage and miss that window for transplant candidacy. I think there's a lot of parallels with amyloid being a progressive disease that really will benefit from early diagnosis and intervention And the delays that we're seeing from these, based on the trial results from the three phase three studies we have, it's clear that diagnostic delays of even months can have a significant impact on cardiovascular outcomes. On that note, let's say the patient has been diagnosed with ATTR in the community or at your center. What's been your experience with getting patients onto therapy? And have you encountered any barriers and I guess any tips about how to navigate that?
We did encounter all the possible barriers at the beginning. As you're aware, these therapies are not inexpensive, and frequently insurance tends to deny these therapies to our patients. So at the beginning, when we open our center, we refer a significant amount of denials for these therapies. We actually have to work with the insurance directly to show the criteria, to show why we are doing this intervention, to show the evidence. So one of the tips is work closer with the insurance companies and work with the persons. Take your pharmacists with you. Take as many people with you to talk and work with insurance so patients can get approved quickly, because these therapies reduce the morbidity and mortality. The second aspect that we encountered was high copays. For the high copays, we created a foundation that helped the patients to get help with their copay. So now they are able to get these medications faster because the copay and the insurance has been open to work with us. And the third component is which therapy you deliver based on the location of the patient. As you are aware, some of these therapies can be injectable. Some of these therapies are oral. And getting access to places where they can get an infusion or injection of these therapies or oral therapies is paramount. Is the pharmacy located in the island that they are located, or is the infusion center located in the island? So work very close with your pharmacy team, and they will be able to help you to navigate these obstacles.
Yeah, I think similar to it takes a village to diagnose a patient with ATTR, it takes a village to care and treat for them. And I think there's a lot of layers to the multidisciplinary team that are crucial for getting patients on therapies and making sure they don't slip through the cracks. I wanted to get your thoughts about access to clinical trials, because I think in disease areas where we have treatments, but they're not curative and there are few treatments, I think clinical trials are an important part of the armamentarium to offer to patients to give them access to best therapies. So I know that you've started to do trials at Queens, and you've certainly referred patients to clinical trials for ATTR. One of the challenges I encounter is that patients have different needs for trials. So there are going to be some that are able to see you regularly, travel, do all the study visits. Others, it's going to take more effort, more resources. And I think that it's important to have as much equity and access to trials as possible. So what's been your experience in this, and any tips for how to work with patients, one, to educate them about trials, but two, to ensure that those that are interested are able to access them?
I think that the first tip is get close to the amyloid community. Even if you're an amyloid center, identify other amyloid partners or other centers that can be your partner, because that will give you access not only to the clinical trials that you can do in your local center, but also clinical trials that you can be available in other centers. In Hawaii, we had the opportunity to work with Stanford and other institutions across the nation. We can send patients to be enrolled in some clinical trials outside of Hawaii. But as I mentioned initially, distance and flight can be very burdensome or significant for these patients. So not everybody have the possibility to travel out of the island. So I am working on my team and I am working to be able to bring those trials to Hawaii, as many as possible. But also, as you're aware, manage a clinical trial involves significant amount of time and effort. So you have to pick which one can give you the best treatment option for your patients in the community. With regard of the patient, something that we have identified is early conversation about the clinical trial and make them understand what is the rationality of the study can help them to make a decision to participate or not. Many of my patients know about the potential clinical trials from the first day that they encounter me. We talk about the disease, we talk about the prognosis, we talk about the current medications or therapies that are approved and the therapies that are under investigation and the opportunity to be enrolled in trials locally in Hawaii and other centers. And as the time goes in different meetings or appointments, we continue to discuss that. I think that that has been the highest yield to be able to help them to get into these trials.
Yeah, well said. So Jesus, I think we're running pretty good time. I was going to wrap up, but just wanted to see if there's any topics that you want to cover that we haven't.
I will say more important for something that we identify here in Hawaii about access to amyloidosis. The problem is multi-level. And if you don't address all the levels at the same time, you won't be able to have access or treat these patients appropriately. Number one, with the patient, help them to get access to your clinic, to your center. We have engaged a lot in telehealth, and that has been helped us to navigate into islands. You can help the patient directly from home. A strong education to providers, to the community providers, primary cares, and cardiologists about how to identify, how to suspect amyloidosis, and the initial evaluation. Number three, some of this barrier is diagnostic tools availability. Educate also the teams, the providers, and being able to get access to these diagnostic tools at the local center. And finally, some of the barriers related to treatment, work with your pharmacy, work with the team that you have to be able to get access to these therapies and be able to decrease the copays and the burden or economical burden associated with these therapies.
That's a great summary, Jesus. I think we covered a lot in a short time. Today, we've talked with Dr. Pino Moreno about addressing the barriers in the diagnosis and treatment of ATTR-CM. Jesus, I'd like to thank you for all the work you've done for delivering care to patients in Hawaii and building the AMLI program there and really meeting patients where they are and diagnosing more with ATTR-CM. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Kevin Alexander for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Transthyretin Amyloid Cardiomyopathy podcast series with our host, Dr. Kevin Alexander. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy.